Left, right and centre, there are still some things that should be held sacred. This week, Sri Lanka, elections, Eurovision and ladies' toilets. Get on the website studentradio.wordpress.com.
Student Radio may contain coarse language and adult content. Listener discretion is advised.
Greetings, Earthlings.
Hello there, and that victorious page in Australia's history that Kevin Rudd mentioned, it is in fact my return.
Indeed.
I'm here to turn a new page on Left, Right and Centre, and indeed the nation.
The X Factor's return, the X Factor being Chris on Left, Right and Centre.
Is that the Roman X is in 10?
Yep, you spoke over me, Casey.
Sorry.
Don't speak over me, please. I'm Matteo. Hello, everyone.
I'm Timothy.
I'm obviously Chris, but everyone already knew that.
And I'm the most important one. I'm Casey.
He is the most important. That's
true. You push the buttons.
This is Left, Right and Centre. I'm going to talk over you again. This is Left, Right and Centre on Radio Adelaide.
Can I just get a word in edgeways?
No.
Go, Casey.
On Radio Adelaide. I hope you enjoy
this. I'm very marginalised on the show.
We hope you enjoy the show. We've got lined up for you today. We enjoy it, we think. This is Radio Adelaide. We hope you enjoy Radio Adelaide as a whole. I'm sure we all enjoy Radio Adelaide around here, don't we, guys?
Indeed, yes.
Maybe not right now.
Look, I have to admit, there's nothing I really enjoy about Radio Adelaide. And in fact, there's something that has really pissed me off, right? I was in the women's toilets earlier today.
What?
As is my want. Look, I was in the women's toilets the other day. Today. And I discovered that they have, like, towelette dedicated for wiping the toilet seat. Now, I'm a hygiene freak, and frankly, I'd appreciate that feature in the men's toilets, but why isn't it in the women's? Why isn't the women's not the men's?
Why were you in the women's toilets?
I can see that might look a bit creepy, mightn't it, Casey?
I know that some of the women are very attractive around the station, but, I mean, they probably don't appreciate you being... watching them in the toilets.
I wasn't watching anyone in the toilets. I can tell you there's a good explanation here, and that is... The male toilets are out of order today. I waited till all of the women had left, so there was no, possibility of any sort of unfortunate incident. And then I used them, and I'm shocked. I'm appalled. And frankly, I think Radio Adelaide needs to take action and install, towelette for wiping the toilet seat in the men's toilets.
You seem racked with bitterness and envy.
I'm angry. I think it's a double standard, and I think it's unfair.
Well, I think you're going to have to stay that way, Christopher.
Yeah. I think that the radio station's got bigger things to worry about.
Okay, well, what are we talking about on the show
tonight? Tonight on the show we've got stories including international conflict abroad in Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
We've got stories about the recent election in Western Australia. We've got all sorts of ridiculous news stories, one about urination coming up later.
We've got a story by our mystery guest.
And we have more budget, don't we, guys? Because I don't think we'd talk about it.
Last
week.
We're not talking about the budget, I don't think.
What? Why am I here?
That's so exciting.
Casey, don't lie.
But what are
let's
we going to talk
off,
about right
Let's
now?
Kick off the show with this. This is a story that aired on Good Morning America on ABC America.
For her first official portrait, Michelle Obama broke with tradition and went sleeveless. Not that it's a shock. As one New York Times writer said, her bare arms have become her constant accessory. On the cover of People and Vogue, at a Stevie Wonder concert the other night. Last week, hosting culinary students in the White House kitchen, she wore a purple Jason Wu dress, then a strapless number that night.
Her kind of philosophy of fashion is that women should wear what they're comfortable in. And so there she is with her arms out.
The other night, when Michelle Obama wore that Narciso Rodriguez while her husband spoke to Congress, the Chicago Tribune's message board lit up.
So most of the complaints centered on the dress conveying a sense of informality on a serious occasion. And there were some people who took umbrage with that.
Some people concerned about Michelle Obama, the First Lady's dress, showing too much arm.
Mm.
I don't know if...
Now, I'm a pretty conservative guy, but I honestly think this is just a huge storm in a teacup. This isn't a story at all. I have very little amounts of patience when it comes to non-stories like this. I don't understand why we're devoting airtime to it.
I think you've got it wrong. I think Proper Lady makes a very good point. Proper Lady wrote on the comments to the Good Morning America story. She wrote that in no way is it silly to question why the First Lady repeatedly exposes so much skin. To those of us over the age of 35, it's inappropriate to do so. Yes, she has nice arms, as many of us do. Yes, she has nice legs, as many of us do. Yet she should never sit for a press event with exposed arms or bare legs, as she often does. If she does not like stockings, then she should wear pants. The American public, those of us over 35, does not want to see the First Lady's bare arms, bare legs, armpits, etc. Where should, quote-unquote, the line be drawn? Is it okay for her husband, the President of the United States, to stop wearing a shirt, tie, or suit? Maybe Barack Obama would feel more comfortable in sweatpants or jeans, but does that make it right? FYI, I'm a 40-year-old black woman, so there's nothing covertly prejudiced about my comments. I'm simply saying there are still some things that should be held sacred. I think she makes a very good point.
Well, there you go. I think Chris and I were talking earlier. Do you think there are any Second Amendment issues here, Christopher?
Well, look, I do. And frankly, I think Matteo's point about, about this being a storm in a teacup is ridiculous. I think arms control is a very serious issue, and I think we need to address it. I think we need to, you know, stop and look at the fact that Michelle Obama is bearing arms, and I don't think it's setting a good example for the rest of the country.
But she's guaranteed that right under the Second Amendment. The right of the people to bear arms shall not be infringed, if my quoting is correct.
Well, that might be true, but then I think this maybe is a good time to raise the issue about whether that amendment should be altered to address the fact. You know, a feminist of mine who's in England...
Hang on, a feminist?
A feminist of mine. A friend who's a feminist, right? A feminist friend. Okay. A feminist. Was talking about how this is a double standard and how, you know, about how males and females in the public eye are treated differently and women are judged much more on their appearance than men are. You know, men wear ill-fitting suits and no comment, right? Which I think is a
fair
point.
That's just because with men and when it comes to clothes, they're very sensitive.
Well, I don't buy that. But can I get back to what my friend says? The trouble with it is we come back to this issue of bearing arms... And again, it's not a good example to set, and I think she should be held accountable for that fact.
I think, you know, this is obviously a very fascinating discussion. There's some very strong opinions here. I personally think this is all a little bit bizarre, and I think we should finish this discussion I'll just editorialise here and finish this with Americans. They say the darndest things.
No, there are some things that just have to be held sacred in this world.
You're right, Casey. You're absolutely right.
No, and I think the people's right to bear arms is one of those things. I think it's incontrovertible. I think it's a riot.
I don't think we're going to solve this discussion tonight.
In the ranks.
I think it's sacrosanct.
Left, right and centre disagree. Mm.
Let us know what you think on the Facebook group, Left, Right and Centre.
Student Radio at O-Week on Radio Adelaide 101.5 FM. As studious as you are.
Something very serious. There have been, in the world, there are a couple of, you know, intrastate conflicts that have been around for quite a while. You've got places in Ireland, Kashmir,
Spain,
places in Europe, Darfur.
Congo.
And one of the ones that's been around and been, you know, there's been a civil war for the last 26 years is Sri Lanka. And we've seen something, I think, rather extraordinary over the past couple of days, is that this is one of the first intrastate conflicts to have been, you know, ended effectively by a military conquest. And we're going to have a bit of a discussion about that and the issues involved. So does anyone have any initial reactions here?
Well, I'll just like to start off by saying let's not underestimate precisely how huge this news is, because I heard it first a couple of days ago. And like you touched upon, Tim, that it was actually ended by one side having just a complete decimation of the other. It's really quite unprecedented, because normally these things are eventually diffused by sort of, you know, diplomatic treaties or some outcome like that.
I'd also to say... it is, like, huge news, and it is a landmark in terms of interstate conflict. But I would like to point out that it's possible that it may not end in the sense that a lot of the Tamil Tigers, obviously the leader has been killed, but a lot of them have actually been fleeing out overseas. And there's some discussion about, at least in the academic community, about whether that might lead to sort of, like... further, as in a more terrorist-based sort of mode of operation, as in directly terrorist, more in the Al-Qaeda mode.
Perhaps we should give a little bit of background here for those who may not be familiar. Sri Lanka is a country, former British colony. They achieved independence in 1948, and there's since then there's been quite a bit of confrontation between the ethnic majority, who are the Sinhalese, yep. And the Sri Lankan Tamils, who form about 14% of the population, the Sinhalese form about 74% of the population. Yep. And there have been consistent problems there, that the Tamils have been, you know, there have been consistent institutionalised discrimination through legislation by the majority and the Sri Lankan government, and the in response, there's been increases in nationalism, and the organisation that we're talking about, the Tamil Tigers, they're essentially a terrorist
militant
rebel
combat
group.
Combat some of this discrimination.
Yeah, and essentially they wanted to set up their own state, Tamil Elam, which would be an independent state for Sri Lankan Tamils. And, you know, the Tamil Tigers, or the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Elam is their name. And I think it's, you know, this is one of those situations where... both sides have committed some terrible atrocities.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what makes it just as complex as it is, because from my point of view, it's difficult to identify which side, you know, has the more legitimate claim, both in the sense that the Sri Lankan government has committed some terrible atrocities, especially since, you know, like, especially since the the offensive in 2006, which sort of, you know, drove the Tamil Tigers back further and further into the... and also by the Tamils, who, as you point out, act like a act essentially as a terrorist organisation.
And I think through the history, that's been. I mean, the MO of the Tamils has been one of you know,
the Tamil Tigers.
Of the Tamil Tigers. Sorry, I should be very careful about making that error. Of the Tamil Tigers has been essentially one of you know, high profile assassinations and an acts of great aggression and suicide bombings against everybody standing in the way, and Tamil, you know,
and
fellow Tamils.
The use of Tamil civilians as shields, basically.
Well, this is something that's very interesting, because one of the big issues and one of the sources of the very large humanitarian outcry just in the past couple of weeks has revolved around essentially Sri Lanka. I imagine most people have an image of it in their minds. At the north, there's sort of a series of peninsulas and islands. And this was where the Tamils were being forced into the last stronghold. Yep. And there was a section of land designated as a no-fire zone, where large amounts of civilians, you know, were essentially, you know, standing, you know, who were caught in the fighting. And what happened is, as the Tamils were being forced back, they essentially took on this, you know, stood on this land, and many, many parties, including independent and international observers, have said that the Tamils have been using these civilians,
the Tamil Tigers,
the Tamil Tigers, pardon me, the Tigers have been using these civilians as human shields.
Yep. And the real problem with it, the thing that makes it more complicated, like using civilians as human shields is terrible, but the Sri Lankan government in some instances continued to fire on in those areas anyway, which makes them as much, if not more, at fault in the first place. So what you can see is that it's an extremely difficult conflict, and both sides are basically at fault.
Well, it's tempting to compare this situation and to make it analogous, with other such conflicts around the world, but it does have its differences, because this is far more protracted and bloodier struggle than a lot of these intrastate conflicts. For example, I'm fascinated by the ongoing situation in Spain with the Basque separatists and ETA, but that's different. That's far more decentralized than this. This is fought along. Not strictly conventional sort of military means, but I mean, the Tamil Tigers do have some sort of, or did have some sort of standing military.
Yeah.
And it's not enough to just say, even though their leader's being killed, it's not enough to just say, oh, well, the head's being cut off, the body will die. Chris, as you alluded to before, there's a quite significant diaspora living outside of Sri Lanka.
The Tamil population,
ethnic Tamils,
is one of the largest diasporas in the world. Partly because so many Tamils have been forced out by the government.
And it's not as if they're going to be appeased by this. Just because the militant wing has been, for the time, extinguished.
Well, but what I would say to that extent is that the nature of the Tamil Tigers has been that they have effectively obliterated all other militant Tamil organisations. They have seen enemies without enemies within. They have treated exactly the same, and they have been convincingly routed. There are no armed Tamils left in Sri Lanka.
Tim, I think perhaps the more interesting issue here is one of responsibility. And this is where there might be some more debate, I think, amongst the team. I'd like to say, from my point of view, that I think, although, as I said, both parties are equally responsible, they've both been responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of, I don't know, civilians, I'd say the government is more responsible in the sense that I think, as a sovereign, you know, entity, theoretically, as the representative of the people, they have a higher responsibility. You know, a terrorist group, you know, do horrible things, but I think a government should behave to a higher standard.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'm sort of torn in this situation, because it's quite a long conflict, and the ethnic Tamils have been treated quite badly through the history of it, and I think essentially the humanitarian crisis has been exacerbated by both sides, and I think people out there, if you as I recommend you do, look into it, you can be more and more horrified with the humanitarian situation.
That's true.
I'd just like to say that you guys know a lot more about this issue than me, and I have very little say.
Well, okay, that's good. I think I'd like to say then that this is another issue left, right, and centre can't solve. So let's go to something else.
There are many we can, but in the meantime, let's go to this.
Yes, it's a marvellous day today for yacht racing, and if you're just joining us, this is coverage of the 47th annual Shoreline Yacht Race, coming to you live from Nebraska, Texas. Of course, according to the official rules, none of the participants in this year's race have ever raced yachts before, but nevertheless, they really are in peak condition. At least one assumes they are. It's actually quite difficult to see in any great deal from the shore here. There is a light fog, but I would say the largest obstacle to clear viewing would be sheer distance. It's very hard to say with any degree of accuracy exactly how many yachts there are out there, much less who's winning. It seems like there is indeed some movement, but then at this distance, that really could be what no movement looks like. The favourite to win this race is number 8, though, as I've said, I can't actually see which boat that is, so if you are really interested in this particular race, a good move would be to turn over to one of the 3 stations which are actually providing coverage from out in the water. Ooh, something's happening. I think I can see, yes, there is certainly some sort of activity in the distance. At this stage, it doesn't seem to be anything to do with the race, but we'll keep you up to date as that unfolds, if indeed it does. Until then, back to the studio.
On left, right and centre on Radio Adelaide, this is left, right and centre. It is 26 past 12.
I always wonder who that strange gentleman is who just wanders into the studio.
It's very mysterious. He sort of comes in wearing a mask. Yeah. We can't see what he looks like, and he just sort of speaks into the mic.
It's mutually beneficial, though, for us. We enjoy it. It's a bit of a break for us. Anyway.
Let's move to one of the biggest political stories of the weekend, the election held in Fremantle on Saturday. It was a by-election triggered by the resignation of the sitting member for the seat, Jim McGuinty. He was the former Attorney General of WA. Left, right and centre's just got the figures in, hot off the presses, and we can confirm that the candidate Adele Carles for the Australian Greens will pick up that seat, snatching it from the Labor Party with 54.89% of the vote to party preferred.
And this is obviously a big deal, and of course because a minor party has got a seat in the lower house, and this is obviously, you know, state election, but
This is the second time that a member of the Australian Greens has won a lower house seat, both times in state parliaments, both times in by-elections. First time was in Cunningham in New South Wales, I think.
And the important thing to point out there is that Labor won it back.
Labor won it back at the next general election.
Yeah. And that's what happens at by-elections. I mean, you oftentimes see large swings away from the major parties. I think the best example of that is the Mayo by-election after Alexander Downer retired, where I think the Liberal Party now hold that seat on the two-party preferred. I think they hold that seat by 1 or 2%.
Yeah, they lost it by had a large swing against them.
Yes, yeah, and which is just ridiculous because it's Mayo. It's one of the crown jewels of the Liberal Party.
Having said that, the Labor Party didn't even field a candidate in there.
Yeah, and well, because the Labor Party, essentially, I think the big parties, the big party in these situations who doesn't hold the seat has nothing to gain from going at by-elections because they are typically dominated by the minor parties.
I think when talking about this issue, it might be interesting to look at what some people have said, and in particular, a comment by the opposition parliamentary secretary Mitch Fifield.
Yeah,
it's an interesting name.
It's a good name.
And he said something which I think is perhaps a little exaggerated. Said Labor is in a very difficult situation with their inner city seats, and will probably see over time those seats falling to the Greens and becoming Green seats rather than Labor seats.
Yeah, that's a sentiment that's echoed by the Greens. In fact, we've got Bob Brown saying Adele's win for the Greens is a real breakthrough for the West Australian politics, but it's also a pointer for Australian politics in the years to come.
And I think it would be very appropriate to use the words delusions of grandeur here. That's exactly what's going on. Well,
you don't think this represents a widespread greening of Australian politics, Tim?
And furthermore, I hope it doesn't, because the last thing we need is a reactionary minor party in lower houses where people are trying to form government. I mean, we see what happens when that happens in Europe.
Tim, you could make an argument that if they came into power, for instance, the Greens would be forced to take a more reasonable approach or face losing. I mean, the Democrats gradually, not that they came into power, but as their influence increased, you know, they became, you know, more reasonable, more circumspect, and as a result, they eventually lost influence.
But if a minor party that's primarily defined by their, shall we say, optimism and political idealism becomes a major party and then turns sort of centrist to appease the majority, it's really not solving any problems.
And if you want my opinion, I don't think Bob Brown has a centrist bone in his body.
Is that a bad thing, though?
Well, no. And this goes to the issue of how Australian democracy works. I don't think it's a bad thing to have people like the Greens and, you know, perhaps more controversially in this particular forum, people like Family First.
You do think that's a bad thing, surely.
No, I do. I think they're okay holding the balance of power in the upper house. But where people are trying to form government and trying to get into the executive, you can't have minor parties mucking around with that. Otherwise, you end up with ridiculous situations, like in Europe.
I think they're perfectly... they're perfectly within their rights to attempt to form, you know, like to attempt to win seats in the lower house, because that's part of the democratic process.
So long as they don't.
Well, look, Tim, I think I agree with you for the most part that having, you know, like a major Green presence in the lower house of parliament probably isn't a good thing, but I don't think you can say they shouldn't be allowed to, or, and I know you're not quite saying that, but yeah, I don't know.
And can I just say the Australian Greens would not be considered at all, you know, particularly alternative or extremist over in Europe. I mean, for one, they're a lot less hateful than a lot of those truly extremist parties.
Yeah, but the problem,
they would represent the centre left.
The problem I refer to in Europe is not that they have crazy, crazy political parties, but the fact that
which they certainly do.
Yeah. It's just in parliamentary democracies in Europe, there are typically situations where the balance of power and the formation of government relies not on, you know, the election of the people, but rather the whim of the leaders of a couple of small minor parties with very, very crazy beliefs who hold balances of power, and people have to put together fragile coalitions. I mean, and Australia's been through periods like that in the past. I think, Chris, you'd know that better than me. I believe in the late 30s there were situations where the government who was forming government would just essentially weigh on the personal feelings of a couple of independents
and would change constantly.
Yeah, and that's not good for a country, and I think we've seen that the you know, economic and social impacts of that in places like Italy, for example.
Look, I guess the most Italy's a very good example. I was actually going to go back to the 30s, not in Australia, but in Germany, late 20s, early 30s. I know I'm bringing up... No, but one of the main problems with the Weimar Republic was that it had an extremely fragmented proportional representation mm-hmm. system, and basically what happened was, you know, like, the proportion of the vote... each party that got a certain proportion of the vote then got exactly that proportion of the seats. And as a result, it was it didn't work, it didn't function, and it caused all sorts of problems, and we all know what that led to.
Yeah. If I can just make one final point on this, the I think another interesting part of this is that the only people who lose out of the Greens gaining seats are the Labor Party, because of course the Liberals aren't going to lose, you know, parts of their vote to a party like the Greens. I think
having said that, I'd be interested to see how much of the... Because the Liberals didn't field a candidate in this election, so they received exactly zero votes, which is a swing of minus 30.2%. I'd be interested in knowing how many of those votes went to the Greens in, you know, people going, in defiantly going, I'm not voting Labor.
I don't think there are many people who would normally vote Lib for the Liberals who would think, you know, rather than voting for the Labor Party, I'll vote for the Greens. And there aren't many. And I think that's the thing. I mean, if a party attacks the Labor Party from the left, it's the Labor Party that are going to lose the seats. And essentially, you know, if heaven forbid we end up in a situation where the Greens are starting to form, you know, starting to be required to form coalitions in lower houses in order to form government, it's the Labor Party that's going to have to form those coalitions, not the Liberals.
So you think the Liberals is going to come out, the coalition will come out of this very strongly if the Greens and Labor Party have to make a coalition effectively?
Yeah, exactly, because the Greens, I think, you know, are sufficiently principled to make building a coalition very, very difficult.
Well, I don't know about you. I think the quote-unquote two-party myth has been quote-unquote forever shattered in Australian politics. It's the voice of the community.
Can I just briefly say... when I was talking about the Weimar Republic, it could have been interpreted that I was trying to compare the Greens to the rise of Nazism. That's not what I was doing. I was comparing them to the GDP, who were the well-meaning but ineffectual party that the weakness of caused their collapse. So just to clarify that, I don't want to give any wrong impressions
there. Nice save, Chris.
There.
By request from one of my colleagues at work, that was Batters with Spider Mother.
That would freak me out. I don't like spiders. I don't like my mother. I would hate...
If your mother turned into a spider?
Yes.
I think I would find a way to reconcile my quite...
stepping on your mother?
My strong arachnophobia with my love of my mother.
What are we going to do now, Casey?
Yeah, we're going to do this now, guys.
That's good, Tim. That's seamless.
Seasoned police are reportedly shocked by the frequency of public urination in the Sydney suburb of Manly, which is said to have reached crisis point. Thousands of dollars worth of fines are apparently issued each month for both men and women in Manly who, according to news.com.au, quote, seek relief after a big night out. The Illawarra Mercury even reports that officials at the Wesley Church of the Mall in Wollongong have requested police protection because the sandstone building is being eroded by public urination and sex, which is also said to have led to discoloration and a stench along the base. As news.com.au fittingly asked, is Manly Australia's biggest public toilet, or do you know of worse?
I can't think of worse. I mean, No, you go, Mateo.
I was just going to yell, crisis time, and then say, they've said that the sandstone building is being eroded by public urination, which I can understand if there was a lot of at very high pressure.
Yeah.
I don't understand how it's being eroded by sex.
It's like...
Is it the friction?
I think it meant the holy aura, actually. I wrote it to read as if the sandstone was physically being eroded. It probably is by the urination, but I think the sex is just because, like, I mean, it's being
desecrated. An erosion of standards.
There's a lot of rubbing of bodies.
It'll be like, you know, in Europe they have to worry about the sandstone buildings because of acid rain, and I thought we'd gotten away with that, but apparently the acidic nature of urine is causing a problem for these landmarks.
If nothing else, that's a good point, Jim. And if nothing else, it suggests that we need to change our diet. Maybe that's the problem. If we altered our diet sufficiently, it wouldn't be a problem. There would be no erosion, and it'd be okay.
Yeah, our more alkaline foods, I think, is the solution.
The only known pig in Afghanistan, normally on public display in the Afghanistan Zoo, has purportedly been quarantined in a locked room because of public concern that it could infect them with swine flu. This is despite the fact that there are no pig farms in Afghanistan and no direct flights between Afghanistan and Mexico, significantly lessening the pig's risk of exposure to the flu. In a fun but unrelated Afghanistan fact, Reuters reports that one fighter climbed into the lion enclosure but was immediately killed by Marjan, the zoo's most famous inhabitant. The man's brother returned the next day and lobbed a hand grenade at the lion, leaving him toothless and blind. So, guys, do the people concerned about this pig giving them swine flu have a legitimate case, or are they just pig-headed?
Hold on. Somebody threw a grenade at a lion?
Yes, they did, Tim. And I seriously think that the swine flu is a misnomer. It's a cover to actually protect the pig, because if it gives someone swine flu, their brother is going to come back and lob a hand grenade at the pig, so we're looking at the safety of the pig as much as the safety of the people.
Can I just say, any ambiguity in this is probably prevented by the fact that anyone who's willing to throw a hand grenade at a lion is probably already toothless and blind. So it's the lion who suffered. And the pig, I meant to say.
An allegedly drunk woman on a horse has been arrested overnight for directing traffic in the north of Adelaide at 4 a.m. The Advertiser reports that police were contacted after the woman, 25, from Salisbury North, was observed directing traffic outside a Parralawi police station. According to police spokesman Senior Constable Paul Noble, she's been charged with, quote, riding a horse under the influence of alcohol. Guys, why don't we have a horse around like that?
Northern suburbs represent. I mean, some mornings I wake up, but I think living in northern suburbs is a bit shit.
Can I just say, Casey, I should... Oh, sorry, Mateo, keep going.
Stories like this pop up, and I think, I love living in the northern suburbs. What other part of the town does this happen in?
I'd just like to say, I don't know, this may be my error, but it was actually a service station, not a police station.
Yeah, that would sound
strange.
That would be a whole new level of stupid.
So I was just a bit freaked out, because I don't want to, you know, mislead anyone and get in trouble.
Hold on, what was she charged with?
Riding a horse under the influence of alcohol.
See, I need to look that up. I would love to see what the common law history of that offence.
It'd be life, Casey.
Well, I think you need to ask the Minister for the Northern Suburbs.
Forgotten their name, but Australian musicians John Butler and Missy Higgins have taken an early lead in Peter's World Sexiest Vegetarian poll. Other celebrities competing with Butler and Higgins in the poll include actors Hayden Panettiere and Emily Deschanel, and comedians Dave Hughes and Chris Lilley. According to a Peter press release, the fact that there are more than 200 gorgeous celebrities in this year's poll means that, quote, a vegetarian diet makes you beautiful inside and out. So, guys, if this is the search for the world's sexiest vegetarian, why are John Butler and Missy Higgins winning?
Can I point out, I mean, I think the reason they're winning is that vegetarianism clearly doesn't make you beautiful. If Chris Lilley and Dave Hughes are included in a list of the 200 most beautiful people, you know, beautiful vegetarians in the world, vegetarians are clearly not very beautiful. Casey himself, our very own, you know, left, right and centre Casey.
Yeah, Casey should have nominated, for
you're
sure.
You're a vegetarian. You're much more attractive than them. And you're still less attractive than the three of us in the studio. Clearly vegetarians are not attractive compared to regular people.
I see no correlation. I think this is a ridiculous publicity stunt. Just, you know...
Where do we get this article from, by the way?
That was very...
Peter sent me a press release.
That was very vehement.
Not me, Chris. Like the station, not me specifically.
Don't you have, like, a Peter... You have Peter, like, Wire?
No.
So you get all their stories?
Can I just ask, would it be breaking the fourth wall if I mentioned the last story again? I just want to ask where the woman got the horse from.
It's breaking the fourth wall if you mention the fourth wall.
For leaders of China's Communist Party, the country's first sex theme park was a G-string too far. Named Loveland, it was set for an October opening in the city of Chongqing. But within hours of a nationwide blaze of publicity for the park, bulldozers moved in to raise all of the how-to workshops and gigantic genitalia. The manager of the park, Liu Chaoqing, defended the venture last week and bemoaned China's lack of sexual openness. He said that, quote, sex is a taboo subject in China, but people really, really need to have more access to information about it. We're building the park for the good of the public. I found that the majority of people support my idea, but I have to pay attention and not make the park look vulgar and nasty. He clearly did not win the support of city propaganda officials. One said that the investigation determined the park's content was vulgar and that it was neither healthy nor educational. It had an evil influence on society and had to be torn down immediately, the Times of India reports. By Monday, the park was history. Guys, what's to be done with all the dismantled attractions? Should they auction off all the presumably giant plastic breasts and penises?
I have no idea.
What are they going to do with it all?
Well, auction it off, clearly.
Auction it off in China?
No, China is a capitalist country now, correct?
No. Look, they're a mixed economy. That's not. I wouldn't say it's effective to call them a capitalist country. I'm just saying. I think maybe they'll be kept by the state.
Yeah, but what perverted social instrument could come up with the idea of a sexual theme park other than the market?
Oh, no, the market came up. It's a mixed economy, Tim. So there are elements of the market with elements of state control.
This is what happens when you have communists and market economies. You get sex theme parks.
Hold on. You have sex theme parks, I can guarantee, in capitalist countries too.
Probably in Germany, in Hamburg.
Otherwise, it'd be advertised as the world's first sex theme park, but this was just China's first.
Yeah,
don't give me that look.
I don't understand.
Our Lady Immaculate and St. Philip Neri Catholic Church in East Sussex has unveiled a bronze statue dubbed, quote, Jesus in Jeans, portraying Christ as a modern man, the Daily Telegraph and the Times of India report. Father David Buckley, at the unveiling of the 16,000-kilogram, 7-foot-high statue, was quoted as saying that, we felt this design summed up the spirit and activity of Christ perfectly, and I think it speaks for itself. On the continent, you often encounter modern representations of Jesus, but it's not so common over here. We wanted a figure of Christ, not in suffering, but dynamic and welcoming. In fact, the statue further depicts the Son of God wearing a shirt, billowing in the wind, while his hair and beard are neatly and fashionably dressed. Guys, does Jesus' newfound good grooming, along with his kindness to others, make him a sensitive New Age guy, a.k.a. a snag?
Sounds like a Calvin Klein model, from what I've... From his description here, I mean, does he have a few buttons of the shirt undone? Can you see a little bit of chest, and also hair billowing? I mean, how long is the hair?
Neatly trimmed hair.
This is clearly the problem. Is that putting Jesus in jeans? I think cheapens the message.
Can I just also say that clearly the world is becoming more religious. This is the second Jesus statue story we've had in a few weeks.
And Tim, it doesn't cheapen the message if they're really expensive jeans.
Good point, Mateo.
And really heavy, expensive statues.
It is actually a very, very heavy statue.
So heavy. 16,000 kilograms. It's only 7 feet high.
Jesus was a very important man.
That is true.
West Virginia police said an 11-year-old girl threatened her younger sister with a pistol after the younger child refused to play with her, the Times of India reports. The 11-year-old then allegedly pointed the .38-caliber pistol at her grandmother, only surrendering the gun after the grandmother made several demands for it. The gun was unloaded, but the police believe the girl was unaware of this. She was held at a juvenile detention centre on charges of domestic assault and brandishing a weapon. It sounds as if the older sister really wanted to play. Tim, have you ever turned to such violence when you didn't get your way at home?
No, I don't have a pistol.
Ooh.
Well, I'm just saying.
But if you had, just hypothetically.
Say you had opportunity.
I don't respond to hypotheticals.
So, okay.
No fun.
This is the same man that scares his sister with a spider.
I've never scared my sister with a spider. I don't think you'll find any evidence of me ever claiming such a thing.
I think if you go to the back issues of Left, Front, and Centre vis-a-vis last week, you'll find you telling a story in which you scared your sister with a spider.
I have not.
So you're saying you're a liar?
Sorry, I'm not claiming.
Facts, guys. Just saying, check the facts.
Looks like your spider story has been caught out for a web of lies.
Hold on. How has this become a vilification of Timothy? There's a serious story here about this has got issues with gun control.
Look, it is a serious story, but the point is, it's a story of siblings abusing other siblings.
And it's a story of hypocrisy. Hypocrisy.
Yeah, hypocrisy, Tim, and your hypocrisy.
Look,
it needs to be exposed, and it has been.
Well done.
That's what we're here for. Police in North Carolina say a teenager who attempted to rob a store with a banana ate it before they could arrive. Authorities in Winston-Salem say that 17-year-old John Zwala held the banana under his shirt when entering the store on Thursday, saying he had a gun and demanding money, the Times of India reports. Store owner Bobby Ray Maybe says that he and a customer jumped Zwala until deputies arrived, but not before the teen ate the banana. Maybe says deputies photographed the offending banana peel. Forsyth County Sheriff Office spokesman Major Brad Stanley claimed that deputies joked about charging Zwala with destroying evidence. Officials say the 17-year-old does not have an attorney. Unofficial reports, however, say the 17-year-old did have an attorney, but he ate him before police arrived. Anyone?
All I was going to say was I'm very proud that I wrote that line. Thank you.
All I can just say is America truly is the land of fruit-related crime and also people with seemingly multiple first names. I mean, Brad Stanley's good, but then the store owner is called Bobby Ray Mabe. That's a good name.
It's not.
It's a good name.
It reminds me of Billy Ray Cyrus.
Which isn't too good a thing.
Mm. That story kind of fizzled out. That's the end of Rapid Fire News for this week. This is an issue that many of us in the panel room grapple with regularly.
Postnatal depression is like living in a fog. You look calm, but inside you feel numb. You dread being alone with your baby. And people don't want to know how you really feel. There's no laughter. You reach a point where you can't do it anymore. It should be the greatest time of your life.
Helping someone through postnatal depression isn't beyond you. To find out more, call Beyond Blue on 1300 224636 or visit beyondblue.org.au.
Welcome back to Left, Right and Centre for another week. I'm radio personality Ford Graham, and now it's time for some breaking news. Police have arrested a single Australian man responsible for replacing 90% of Australia's population of bees with foreign bees. The gentleman has reportedly been smuggling as many as 20 bees a year into the country and using them to replace Australia's own population one at a time. Scientists estimate that within the next 30 years, all bees in Australia would have passed through the hands of this man if he hadn't been found out. In a bizarre turn of events, the neighbour responsible for tipping off the police was later convicted himself for trying to replace the entire Australian population of cows using the same methods. Well, that's what's in the news, and now here's what's coming from you, the listeners, as we bring you the results of last week's writing competition. We asked you to write and tell us why you hate peanut butter in 25 words or less, and the winner is a Mr. Ed Holden of Humber Crescent, Adelaide, who said he didn't like peanut butter because it prevents him from breathing. Well, congratulations, Mr. Holden. Your prize of a lifetime supply of peanut butter is on its way. Finally, I'd just like to point out that if any other listeners need a radio presenter, I'm open for new job opportunities. Just call Radio Adelaide and leave a message for Ford Graham. Ford Graham. But now, here is something soothing from the 60s.
I think I can honestly say without any hyperbole that that is the greatest song of all time. Sam Cooke with The Change Is Gonna Come.
I think there's quite a lot of hyperbole.
Yeah, and I think, Tim, we might actually want to check the records again, because I'm quite sure you've said that before. So if anyone has a better knowledge of the Left, Right and Centre back catalogue than I do, check him out.
I have honestly never said that before. There are two songs I would consider saying that about, and this one is one of them.
The other one's by Bob Dylan, isn't it?
No.
No, the other one's by Don McLean.
Nope.
Fine, I don't know your music taste, but...
I will say it again one more time before the show is out.
That is undoubtedly a jewel in Motown's crown. Great song there.
On Radio Adelaide, it is 8 minutes to 1am. In Reykjavik, it's currently 12 degrees Celsius. Now, we're coming to the end of the show, but there is one story we haven't yet discussed, and it's perhaps... I know I said this earlier, it's perhaps the biggest political story of the weekend.
The year, perhaps.
Of the year, even, yeah.
This is the
certainly
granddaddy.
Of this year.
Yeah, this is the... We are, of course, talking about the... Annual Eurovision Song Contest.
Sorry, Casey, I jumped the gun there. Botched that one a little bit, guys.
This year held in Moscow. I think the host there did a wonderful job.
The host country did
fantastically, presenting such a good show. All of the kitschy music we expect. Did anyone have any highlights from the night?
I did have some highlights. I think the pool thing, did anyone see the pool? What happened was they were like swimming pools and they were above the audience and sort of people swimming in them and sort of jumping They were standing up, they jumped down onto the pool surface, and the pools gradually got lowered towards the audience and were, like, probably a metre above their heads or less.
You mean
it
like
was
that,
incredible.
You mean like that scene in Star Wars where they're in the rubbish compactor and it slowly comes in and they're terrified because they're going to get crushed? Is that what it was like?
No, because the audience were thrilled to have semi-naked performances.
That they were semi-naked.
So the idea of imminent death wasn't around?
Not really. Oh. I think it was sort of excitement. I'd also like to mention that I'm disappointed that... Casey didn't read the temperature in Oslo, because I want to know how cold the winner of Eurovision is at the moment.
From Norway.
I can find out what weather Alexander Rybak, the winner, is returning to. It is actually 14 degrees currently in Oslo. It's mostly cloudy, with southwesterly winds at 14 kilometres an hour. Humidity is 63%.
And actually, Matteo, I think there's, now that we're talking about Eurovision, there's something that a grudge I've held for a while that might be relevant to talk about here.
Oh, okay, so it's all coming out now.
It is coming out now.
Funny that it's on radio.
Last year, Matteo deliberately and willfully revealed the winner of Eurovision to me.
I thought you already knew who the winner was.
You did not. You did not think that.
Okay, so maybe I
won't. So you're saying,
maybe
I'm so excited for Eurovision tonight,
and
Matteo goes, well, too bad, because Russia wins.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened.
I didn't... Yeah.
And this year, he even sent me a text message saying, and I quote, or it's a shame I couldn't ruin Eurovision for you this year. He sent me that text message. I have it here with me. You can, you know, approach me on, in the street and ask me.
And what you will read
and
out
as it
to
happens,
them.
Guys, the bombshell is I ruined Eurovision for myself. 5 minutes before Eurovision went to air, I saw it in a news break that ambushed me and said, Norway wins Eurovision in landslide.
There should be a law against that kind of thing.
I might be alone here, but doesn't Eurovision ruin Eurovision? I mean, it's just terrible.
That is blasphemy, Tim.
It's just, look, there's clearly something I'm not getting here. It's just terrible, terrible music.
The vote, Tim, apart from the fun of the songs, the voting is a microcosm of European diplomatic policy. You have voting blocks, Russia.
I don't think it is.
Oh, no, I think it is. Well, I think it is. The small former Soviet countries support Russia much in the same way they do in real life. I think that's, you know, demonstrable. That's representative of the current political situation in Europe.
Well, as somebody who doesn't study international politics, I don't find that particularly interesting. And the voting is even worse because you have to put up with them repeating everything in another language. No, it's like
that's the best part. That's I enjoy the hearing the French say nil pois.
But it's like I don't understand what you're saying. Please why don't you speak English? Because Tim, isn't that what they speak in Europe?
Okay, Tim. What about if they're if the people announcing the votes are drunk, like hilariously drunk, or they try and sing all the points, or they sing the winning songs? Isn't that hilarious?
No, it's just bad music. I don't understand.
No. It's not music. They're drunk.
It's not music. It's theatre.
It's theatre. Look, Eurovision is brilliant. I think Tim's wrong.
Can I just say that the highlight of this year's Eurovision for me was not watching any of it.
I had
any
many
of the three
highlights.
Evenings, and in fact spending most of my time either working or not writing an essay. That's how I spent my time. Far more constructive,
I
I'm sure,
you
agree,
about.
Than writing it.
Look,
than
yeah,
watching
look, Mateo, frankly, compared to Eurovision, I don't think what you did with your time is in any way relevant, and I don't think you should be talking about it.
I can tell you all my highlights from Eurovision, but it would take far too long.
I agree.
It's time for us to get out of here, skedaddle, vamoose. We're going to be ejected.
Yeah. They come and kick us out.
There are security guards lining up as we speak.
They're just outside now.
And they're carrying rather nasty-looking batons, and I don't want to be hit.
And bananas.
They might eat them, I suppose.
It's been a great show, etc., etc. Been lovely having you.
Yeah. No, thanks.
We look forward to having you again, I guess. Maybe.
One of those things that family does for each other.
Unfortunate relatives you have to sort of deal with.
Just put up with.
There's clearly a metaphor going in here. I don't understand.
Crazy uncle out in the audience. I hope you come back next week.
What?
Tim doesn't understand what's going on.
Tim doesn't understand. I'd like to, because I know Tim really appreciates this word, I'd like to give another final shout out to my Freminist who brought up the Michelle Obama thing with me and sign off as Chris as usual.
And I'd like to outintroduce myself as Casey as usual.
I think it's possible Chris to actually use two words that Tim hates. I'm sure he doesn't like the word.
No,
shout
also
out.
I coined Freminist, so it's, you know.
Chris didn't use any words I hate. He didn't use correct words. They're not words unless they're in the Oxford English Dictionary, all right?
Just say goodbye, Tim.
I was going to say, on that, I'm actually going to work for the Oxford English Dictionary and insert my words into it.
Or just write them in pen,
yeah. Tim. They would technically be in the Oxford English Dictionary.
I'm Timothy, and I'm incredibly frustrated.
I have been Mateo.
And don't forget the Facebook group Left, Right and Centre and the email address leftrightandcentre@live.com.au. On behalf of the team, cha-cha.